businesses, Hunter, et cetera, and others, located on the police service or at Key River Republic Council, Daniel R. Coro, now known as Lee.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, William Sleeth of the law firm of Gordon and Reese, formerly with Claire Ryan. I'd ask to please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Two?
Yes, please. Thank you. Your Honors, there were 7 assignments of error granted. I don't believe my time leaves me with the ability to go through them all, so I will focus on what I think some of my strongest points are. This case involves my client, Chip Hunter, and he was presented with a dilemma when his mother passed away. And that dilemma boiled down to the fact that he came across a financial statement that showed his parents' assets in 2009 being approximately $4.25 million, but then in 2015, being approximately $1.7 million. So Chip, as a beneficiary of his parents' trust, quite logically wanted to know what happened that they went from $4.25 million down to about $1.79 million in the course of a few years when the stock market returned positive gains all those years, and in some years, significant gains. What Chip Hunter did was had his counsel make a request to his sister, who is the trustee, the parents' trust, and ask, what happened? His sister responded that she would not provide that information before the date the mother died. And then so Chip was left with the dilemma. And the dilemma boiled down to this. The dilemma was that Chip's mother's trust contained a provision in it that purported to try to waive a inform and report requirement in the Virginia Uniform Trust Code, but it referenced an old provision. And so the dilemma can be summed up as this. The trust purported to waive an obsolete code reference. That obsolete code reference did not say, as amended, as numerous other provisions in that same trust did say, as amended, or as an effect here today.
Is that, from your perspective, that's your best argument?
I wouldn't say it's my best argument, but I'd certainly say it's a strong one, because I believe under basic principles of statutory interpretation that where all language has to be given effect.
Well, was it actually amended? I mean, the language put somewhere else in the code, but was it actually amended?
I believe that the code section was it was amended and recodified from Title 55 to 64.2.
So we have lots of arguments up here about recodification. Absent a clear indication that some change was indicated by the legislature, we presume there was no change.
I understand that. My argument is, if the drafter of the trust presumed that, they would have used language to indicate that, as they did in other provisions of the trust. And in fact, we don't even need to really reach the disposition of that argument. I put that forward to show that Chip Hunter faced a very a logical question about ambiguity here.
So the point is not that, it kicks me out, the waiver applies, and I want a court to rule that's invalid, nullified, set aside, rendered unenforceable. Your point is, no, it actually doesn't mean what the trustee thinks it means, and I'm not challenging it at all. In fact, I just want you to say, Judge, interpret the clause correctly.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We wanted simply an interpretation, and we followed the roadmap set out by this court in the Goodrich case from 1993. And the record shows the complaint was patterned exactly off of Goodrich. It quoted from Goodrich. It said, this petition seeks nothing more than to follow Goodrich. First, we seek a declaratory judgment as to whether this action is going to trigger the no contest clause, and then if and only if it does, proceed with the relief. That's all. It was a very modest, conservative thing that Chip Hunter was seeking to
from the trial court. Isn't the problem with your analysis or your following the pattern of Goodrich is that this particular trust seemed to have language that Goodrich did not, which seems to say that even if you're just seeking an interpretation, which Goodrich was, unless the trustee agrees to it, then you violated the code, isn't it? I mean, you violated the provision. Isn't that language different from Goodrich?
Your Honor's correct that there is language in this trust that says, that gives the trustee discretion as to decide whether an interpretation action wouldn't fall with under the no contest clause. My contention is our petition didn't fall under the no contest clause such that it wouldn't be a call for the trustee to have to make as to whether the trustee thought that even though it fell under the no contest clause, it was permissible. I probably didn't explain it clearly enough. The language in the trust here said, it talked about the no contest clause, and then it said the things that won't fall under this no contest clause are a request for interpretation as long as the trustee consents to it.
Which is a truism, because a trustee can waive anything in this document.
Right, and not surprisingly, the trustee self-servingly said, well, I don't approve it. Of course she didn't, because she stood to receive significantly financially about it. But my contention, Your Honor, in response to your question, is that this never triggered the no contest clause in the first place, such that we never got to the point where the trustee would then be called on to say, well, even though it triggered the no contest clause, I can exempt it from it.
So they made an exception in this second clause to a rule that didn't even apply to your case to begin with.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. And so what Mr. Hunter did was he proceeded simply trying to follow the roadmap of Goodrich that this court has laid out for parties as to how they can confront these difficult situations. These are very difficult situations because there's lots of money at stake in these situations involving no contest clauses. And I think most members of the bar were under the impression that post-1993, when this court handed down its Goodrich decision, was that members of this bar could rely on. And this ruling by the trial court here really calls that into question of what does Goodrich even say? Can we rely on it? Is it a safeguard anymore? So going beyond Goodrich, we also contend that the language in the trust could not waive the independent common law duty of a trustee under Virginia law to provide an accounting. And that was pronounced in this court's Fletcher case that this court handed down in 1997.
But why, if you were right on your first point that the forfeiture clause was not triggered as a matter of law, and if you were to win that point, why would we get into the merits of the case? The merits of the case have not been addressed by the trial court.
Your Honor, I agree. If we were to win on that point, then that would be that.
But if you lose on that point, no one cares to get into the merits on your behalf. It seems to me to be a superfluous point. You've got a doomsday weapon that you just got hit by, and if you get out of that doomsday weapon, you can start talking about the merits of the case. But if the doomsday weapon takes you out, there's nothing more for you to say.
I make the point that if the doomsday weapon, as you say, didn't get us out, we have to look at the reason for the trial court's ruling. And what the trial court held was when Mr. Hunter came into court and said, Judge, we have all these ambiguities over how this waiver language works in light of all these other obligations to provide information here. One of the bases Mr. Hunter made his claim on in the petition for the information was based upon the common law duty to account.
I get it, but the point is that the forfeiture clause, the interim clause, applies even when you're right. So, I mean, the merits of being right or wrong in your interpretation argument, or, for that matter, the merits of being right or wrong in your invalidation claim, which Goodrich would say triggers the doomsday weapon, it makes all of the merits analysis, as I understand it, correct me if my logic is wrong here, just irrelevant. The only question is the deck action seeking interpretation covered by forfeiture? If the answer is no, then it goes back down for all of the questions that you're asking about, the role of common law preceding the statute, the UTC, and the amendments to the Uniform Act. Why would we discuss that in this case, no matter what the court rules on the first question of forfeiture?
Your Honor, I'd submit that if the court did not rule in my client's favor on the question of forfeiture, because of how my client brought the petition before the court, seeking, among other things, clarification on the common law accounting, that there has to be a determination as to whether there was a valid basis for my client to seek a common law accounting. Given
that the question is there a valid basis to seek an interpretation on whether or not there is an independent freestanding common law obligation to report to the beneficiaries?
I think there has to be, based on the language of the petition, which asks the court to clarify the issue of the interpretation. In other words, I don't think the trial court could come to an adequate interpretation of the language of the trust without reaching that issue, because it's bound up in how does this language in the trust. See, maybe I can explain it clearly. Eleanor Hunter tried to argue that when my client filed his petition, he's seeking to avoid the effect of the language of the trust. That waiver of the informal report requirement in old Title 50.
But your argument is I'm not trying to do that at all, because I don't think it says that. I'm not trying to invalidate it. That's
right.
Your wrong interpretation.
Right. That's my thing. My point is, though, even if the court were to disagree with me on that preliminary issue, we have to reach the issue of the other arguments, the common law accounting and whatnot, in order to determine, was the court correct in that Mr. Hunter was trying to avoid the effect of that? Because my contention is, Mr. Hunter wasn't trying to simply avoid the effect of that. He was trying to get his rights to the information that he had. So if Mr. Hunter had independent rights to this trust information, he could not have been trying to avoid the effect of that provision, because he had other avenues in which to get those rights. So on that basis, I submit that reaching the issue of the common law accounting and all the other issues we raised in our brief are, in fact, relevant. Again, if the court were to rule against my client on that threshold issue of interpretation. So with respect to the independent common law duty to account, this court handed down its Fletcher ruling in 1997. This court's never disavowed that ruling. The Virginia General Assembly adopted the Uniform Trust Code in 2005. The Virginia General Assembly said when it adopted the Uniform Trust Code that the trust code will be read consistently with principles of common law. There was nothing in the text of the Uniform Trust Code to disavow this court's ruling in Fletcher. And in fact, this court's jurisprudence says that a statutory provision will not be held to change the common law unless the legislative intent to do so is plainly manifested.
But that's different from a statute codifying the common law. A statute that codifies the common law is not in derogation at all. So all the strict construction principles are beside the point.
I'd submit that the Uniform Trust Code didn't codify the common law, because we know that this court and its various opinions in Rafalco versus Georgiades a few years ago, cited the Uniform Trust Code and the common law side by side. So the Uniform Trust Code did not merely render obsolete the common law.
I was in dissent in the case, but the majority opinion in that case quite accurately used common law to inform the meaning of the statutory codification of common law. It didn't, tell me if I'm wrong on this, say there are freestanding causes of action, a statutory codification of a common law right, and independently of that, even if that didn't exist, a common law claim. In other words, all you're really saying is the waiver clause has to say waive the statutory duty to report and waive the common law duty to report. Why doesn't the statute codify the common law so saying waiving the statute waives both?
Because first off, because that's not what the trust said here. Second off, The statute relating to inform or report in 64, Title 64.2775 provides for provisions separate and apart from what this court in Fletcher 97 stated with respect to the common law. For example, it goes into much more detail and says things like the trustee has to provide respective market values and things. It go kind of beyond what Fletcher talked about.
But if the statute incorporates the common law and expands upon it, why does that mean that the codification portion of the statute has not occurred?
I believe it does, but it doesn't mean the common law goes away in the sense that where the statute comes into play here is because it purports to be waived, right? And we have in the UTC the default rules that you can't draft around, right? And the North Carolina Court in Wilson examined this exact issue. And it said, which I commend to this court for consideration, given the North Carolina common law on this issue, even though North Carolina codified the UTC, and even though in the mandatory provisions it left out the informal report requirement, under the mandatory provision that says you must act in good faith, the accounting requirement is read into that despite the fact that the informal report provisions were not in the mandatory provisions. And those are the facts of the Wilson case in North Carolina are exactly on point with our situation here, where Virginia, just like North Carolina, did not adopt in the mandatory provisions the informal report requirement, just like North Carolina did. But North Carolina looked at the common law and said that the duty to act in good faith, which was a mandatory provision, read in light of the common law, combines to require that in order for a trustee to act in good faith means they have to give that information to the
party.
Has
he answered your question? All right, your time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Dan Quarles. I represent the trustee, Eleanor Hunter. It is a cardinal principle of the law of trust to give effect to the known wishes of the settlor. Here there are two known wishes of the settlor that are relevant to this appeal. Number one, the settlor wished for her trustee not to have to inform and report to the beneficiary in the manner required by Virginia's inform and report statute. Number two, the settlor did not wish for the beneficiary and the trustee to be involved in litigation involving the provisions of the trust.
Isn't that a little broad, to be involved in litigation? Because the definition of contesting is invalidate, nullify, set aside, render unenforceable.
Correct. I spoke overly broadly.
So, I mean, if you come into court and you say, look, I don't think this clause means at all what they say. I'm not trying to invalidate the clause. I get the clause. I disagree with their interpretation. And they just want a deck action to say, no, Mr. Kelsey, you're right or wrong. And I'll deal with it after I find that out. Invalidate is, I know what it says, but I'm just not going to do it, and I don't think a court should make me do it.
Well, I think the latter is the true case here. I think that's precisely what the goal of the lawsuit was to invalidate and avoid the effect of Article 7I of the trust.
Well, then I wish Goodrich hadn't invited it, because honestly, when I read Goodrich, it seemed to me we were implicitly saying you can structure it this way. It's a little bit semantic, obviously. All of what we're talking about is highly semantic. But this is a fair compromise on how to provide access to the courts without triggering a doomsday weapon.
I've read Goodrich a number of times, but that aspect of the case avoids me. I read Goodrich to be just another one of many cases that this court has decided, which says that in determining whether or not a no contest provision has been actuated, you look at it's a case-by-case determination. And you look at the conduct of the beneficiary, and you compare it to the language of the no contest clause.
Can I keep pressing in a bit? But didn't Goodrich flat out say that the general principle of law is that if you seek a judicial interpretation, that is not a triggering event for interim clause?
I don't think that they made that general pronouncement. I think that they found that the the deck action in that case had not violated the no contest provision in that case.
Why? Why didn't it violate it?
Because that no contest provision apparently had different verbiage.
Well, specifically, wasn't it because the deck action was seeking an interpretation as opposed to making an effort to nullify a known interpretation?
It may have been in that case, but the verbiage of the no contest provision in this case specifically precludes that. So in the Goodrich case, they looked at a deck action was filed, that is true, but the verbiage of the no contest provision in the Goodrich case did not prohibit that activity. So when they looked at what he did, they said this deck action did not violate the verbiage of this no contest clause.
Okay, then let me circle back and at least bring me to closure on this. If you're seeking an interpretation in a deck action, and that's they're the master of their complaint, that was their first argument, and they had requested, if this conclusion is wrong, don't go to argument number two. We're not asking you to do it. If you're seeking an interpretation, is that invalidating the provision? Is that nullifying the provision? Is it setting aside the provision? Is it rendering unenforceable the provision? Because that's the definition of contesting under this agreement.
The way that the judge came to rule on the no contest provision, whether it was violated, was not through a trial where count one was presented. We filed a counterclaim, and the counterclaim said, Judge, this complaint in its entirety is an effort to avoid the effect of Article 7I.
It was a summary judgment, was it not?
Yes, sir, Judge.
All right, so he entered summary judgment on the counterclaim, and we're looking at a provision that's really not unclear. So if interpretation is a drop-down from invalidate, nullify, set aside, and Goodrich protects that, and semantically it seems like it's a pretty good distinction, and nothing else in this document says that interpretation, no, interpretation is the same thing as invalidation, then the judge was wrong. But, as you point out, if this document were to say, no, interpretation, as far as we're concerned, is the same thing as invalidation. So your only argument I see is this exception provision, which seems to me to be superfluous. You're making an exception to something that doesn't need an exception. The rule doesn't apply.
Justice, I believe that the no contest provision in this case specifically prohibits filing declaratory judgment actions unless they were consented to by the trustee. And it's affirmatively in the record that the trustee alerted the beneficiary that he did not consent, that she did not consent.
Well, let's look at the clause. It's at page 32, subsection C. For the purpose of this article, this is what contesting, which triggers the doomsday, means. Invalidate, nullify, set aside, etc. Then it says, provided, however, that the trustee, in interpretation matters, can just agree to it and not worry about it. When I first read that, I thought, well, the trustee can agree to anything and waive anything he wants to waive, she wants to waive. But there's no reason to make an exception for something that's inapplicable on its face. In other words, it's a very poorly drafted proviso, and all of this under Goodrich and every other case is strictly construed against you. So it seems to me you've got a really liberal interpretation in your favor, contrary to the standard of construction, in a case where it doesn't appear semantically that the words even say what you say.
Judge, I think we disagree on the import of the Goodrich case, because again, I do not read the Goodrich case to create a blanket exception for declaratory judgment actions in every case. My understanding or reading the Goodrich case was that particular beneficiary filed a declaratory judgment action. In court, in the reading of the no contest provision that was applicable to it, found that declaratory judgment action did not violate that no contest clause.
Believe it or not, I agree with everything you just said. So
okay.
Tell me why this provision makes interpretation the same thing as invalidation.
Count one says that it seeks an interpretation, but just saying that doesn't make it so. The real thrust of the complaint is to avoid the effect of Article 7. There would not be a count one unless the plaintiff wanted to reach count two. So the complaint in its entirety seeks to avoid the effect of Article 7 of the trust.
Well, the plaintiff might want to reach count 2, but he specifically says, if by reaching count 2 I am going to violate the anti-terrorism clause, then don't reach count 2.
Yes, sir.
Is there any doubt? I mean, I understand. We all understand what he wanted. But the issue is, what did he ask for?
Yes, sir. He does ask for that. You're absolutely correct. But what I would suggest is that there is just no precedent in American jurisprudence or other jurisprudence for that kind of mother may I pleading. And to open the door to and allow that would essentially render the effect, the positive effect of no contest provisions of preventing litigation, that would just go out the window. Because everyone
doesn't say, but the no, again, and this Justice Kelsey has already reached this, it doesn't say no litigation, it says no contest. And so what's the harm of having litigation to determine whether it's a contest or not, in order to interpret what do you mean by contest?
Because that's against the wishes of the settlor.
The settlor didn't want a contest.
Correct.
The settlor didn't say, I don't want litigation, but actually we've become circular at this point, so I won't require you to speak further.
Yes, and another aspect of that, which I do address in the brief, is that in reality there's not really a declaratory judgment that needs to be made about language or interpretation of the trust. The trust says very unambiguously that she wants to relieve the trustee of the duty to inform and report in accordance with the statute. And the statute at the time said that it hasn't changed. The wording of the statute is exactly the same, although the codification has changed.
So all you're really saying is you would win the deck action. But deck actions, no one knows who's going to win when you start off. I could easily see the at least prima facie argument about the role of a freestanding common law duty to report, notwithstanding a codification by the UTC, particularly based upon the amendment changes or the failure to include all of the recent amendments to the UTC in Virginia. That's not a bad faith argument or a frivolous legal argument. It may be wrong, but it's not ridiculous. So if what I hear you saying is what I think is right, is you can't file a deck action for an interpretation if you lose it. But no one knows that when you come into a deck action.
Well, what I'm saying is that this count one is really only created to provide some kind of cover to behind which the beneficiary is really trying to get to count two.
Okay, well, then let's unpack that. Suppose in your understanding of the law, he had only filed a count one deck action. Did not mention the if I lose count one, don't go to count. He didn't mention anything about count two. Could he have done that? Could he have simply filed a deck action and flat out said, I do not understand this clause. All the judges talking about common law and statutory has always confused me. Even the judges seem to be confused from time to time on it. So please someone tell me what it means, because I don't think it means what the trustee says it means. Judge, that's all I'm asking, not asking for anything else. Could he have done that without triggering your understanding of the interim clause?
I don't think he could have, because I think that the no contest provision prohibits the filing of the deck action unless it's consented to by the trustee. Now, I have to admit, I haven't spent a lot of time analyzing the hypothetical that you just posed, because in fact, it's not what happened. In fact, what happened is he went ahead and filed count two with count one, and notwithstanding the mother may I pleading component, and again...
Then why did Goodrich rule what it ruled? Why wouldn't Goodrich have said this? Look, I know what you really want initially is an interpretation, but in the end you want to win on the merits, and the fact that you're saying that anywhere in the complaint means if that's where you're heading, ultimately I'm going to trigger the interim clause.
Well, I think that's what happened in the Goodrich case. In the Goodrich case, there is reference to the fact that the plaintiff in that case did this mother may I style pleading. There is no indication anywhere in the Goodrich case that the court's decision was based on the fact that he did that. The court went ahead and looked at the conduct of the beneficiary, compared it against the no contest clause, and said you didn't violate it. They didn't say you didn't violate it because you did this mother may I pleading.
No, I was thinking the opposite. That if I'm understanding your argument would be because you did the mother may I, we don't care if it's interpretation or not in count one, you're hosed because you're ultimately using the interpretation to eventually get to a nullification ruling. That would have been, if I had written Goodwich, and if you're logical right, that's exactly what I would have said. Well, I don't need to worry about interpretation versus invalidation. You ultimately seek, in the alternative, invalidation. And as a matter of law, it triggers the clause.
That's precisely what I'm saying. So,
but that's not what happened in Goodrich. That's my point.
I'm sorry?
That's not what happened in Goodrich. We didn't say that, did we?
I did not read anything in the Goodrich case that led me to believe that they did not find a violation of the no contest clause because of the two-step pleading. I see that they referenced that he had pleaded in that fashion. I see that that's noted, but I didn't see anywhere in the holding where the outcome that he didn't violate the no contest clause, that was the dispositive reason that they found that.
I think we're talking past each other, but go ahead.
So primacy to the wishes of the settlor is a guiding principle of the law of trust. Here, the settlor did not want her trustee to have to inform and report under the...
But isn't that the heart of it, though? Is that what did the settlor want? Was it triggered to the specific code provision that has now been moved? And I mean, it seems like pretty thin gruel on the deck action on the specific clause, because all that happened was it was moved. It wasn't completely overhauled. But that's the question, isn't it? What did the settlor intend? To tether the duty to report specifically to this one statute and no other, even if it's just moved? Or was it a broader, as you say, just across the board, no duty to account? And isn't that what he's saying, is that, well, we're trying to sort that out. And then is there some hovering residual common law rule?
Exactly. And I'm afraid I'm not going to have anywhere near time left to dig into all that. But the settlor said, I don't want the trustee to have to inform and report in accordance as required by Statute X, Title 55-548.13. So at that time, that statute said the trustee must do X, Y, Z. It was recodified, and it still says, trustee says, you must do X, Y, Z. It's word for word the same, nothing has changed. And then when the suit is filed, what count two wants, the prayer for relief, is for the trustee to do X, Y, Z. So the settlor did not want her to do X, Y, Z. He's trying to force her to do X, Y, Z. So I've run out of time. I'm afraid I can't reach any of the issues about common law. Thank you.
Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.